Welcome in, listeners, to another episode of the Busby Babe podcast. I'm your host, Colin Dams, joined by Polly Questel and a special guest today, Nathan Heinschel.
Glad to be a part of this, Colin. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, we finally got Nathan back on the pod. It was a rough end to the USL season for the Richmond Kickers, but it is worth noting that Nathan is a double award-winning tweeter, account manager, admin for the Richmond Kickers for his performances this season, and well-deserved as well.
Hey, you know, I just want to do good work, good public relations. It's a team effort. I'm made better by my colleagues, and I'm just happy to be recognized.
Who gives out these awards? Because I feel like the Busby Babe should get some recognition for the memes that Nathan does.
Yes. So the first award that I won was the Starting 11 Best in PR Broadcasting Award by USL League One. That was chosen by USL United Soccer League executives. And then the second one was the Best in Communications Peer Voted. And that was voted by my peers, obviously, as it's said in the title of the trophy. It was nice to have my work recognized both by my superiors and my equals. So pretty cool. Also glad I didn't get stopped in airport security wondering why I had two glass rectangles in my backpack. So
I would have just been carrying them in both hands. Like, that's my carry on.
One of the principles of the Richmond Kickers, we want to, you know, this is the standard we're setting. We want to be humble about it, you know. And so otherwise I would have been doing trophy lifts at the Tampa Bay Lightning Arena that I was at. I would have been doing it at the Tampa airport. Yeah. So a very satisfying 3 days.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, Nathan. And I agree with Polly. I think there should be equal recognition for your work for the Busby Babe. And maybe if SB Nation had like their own version of the SBs, but it's like the SBs.
Jeremiah O'Shawn, are you listening right now? This is free ideas.
At Jeremiah, this is free content.
Right. That's why we should stop. We don't give away our ideas for free.
Yeah.
Time to go in the general Slack right now.
Give me more promotions and maybe I'll consider posting.
We definitely win the account, the award, Best Regurgitation of Succession Memes.
Yeah.
I don't think there's another site that comes close to the Busby Babe.
We did get a lot of recognition during COVID as like the one site that everybody, that readership didn't drop. So thank you to everybody for
we were just constantly spewing whatever we
when we were writing absolute nonsense.
We did a great job of exploiting the situation and giving you guys good content.
And that's a good segue into this week where we have nothing to talk about.
Right. Well, it's not that we don't have anything to talk about. It's that it feels almost weird and probably not doing justice to the current situation that we would talk about what we missed. Because, like listeners would know and pointed out on Twitter, we didn't have an episode last week to cover the beginning of the Ralf Rangnick era. And this week, the dominating news is that almost the entire Manchester United squad is in isolation, either because they have COVID or they've been exposed to each other. So
Walkhurst tweeted today that like they would have had 9 first team players available to face Brentford and 7 to face Brighton, which
play the kids,
which is a little scary. Yeah, we did that against Young Boys, and it
well,
their young boys were better than ours.
The thing about calling up that many.
What's
kids,
scary though is that they tweeted yesterday how many players reported to Carrington, and it was more than 7 first teamers. So that means that the ones who are not available were around the rest of the first team and exposed them.
Right. And I'm pretty sure this has been happening across sports where just more and more positive cases are turning up. But
Joshua Kimmich.
Yeah. Come to the Premier League where there's no vaccine mandate.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, we're in a situation now where, you know, Premier League managers are calling for this current round of fixtures to be postponed. The British government has announced new mandates limiting travel and the rest of Europe has already started going back to closed door stadiums, if not just canceling games outright, because COVID's getting bad again. And there's really no way around it. And, you know, obviously, as we've learned over the past couple of years, the true value of the Premier League's product is going to take, it's going to be more treated more importantly than player safety and staff safety. If we have to go back to playing behind closed doors, that's probably, you know, what it'll happen at this point. But you imagine they'll want to do it sooner rather than later.
See, I don't know if that's the case. I think we can throw any pretense of the Premier League trying to do the right thing out the window at this point. We've always known this, but because it's almost like when you watch the World Series of Poker, and the camera shows you like what the player's holding. But you know, the other players don't know. So like, we've kind of gotten a glimpse at what cards everybody is holding, but in the last year and a half, they've just straight up put them on the table. Money trumps all. And that's true for the Premier League. That's true for all 20 owners and clubs in the Premier League. And that's especially true for the Super League clubs. Everybody's put their cards on the table. It's money that trumps all, and it's the FA, the Premier League, UEFA, FIFA. Nothing is going to get canceled. Like, a very easy step to manage the past year would have been to just cancel the UEFA Nations League. Be like, hey, it's behind closed doors games anyway, and it's a tournament that we just invented. We could put it on pause. Like, we don't need to play three international games in a 10-day international break. But we didn't, because UEFA is like, no, we have a TV contract. And if the Premier League is getting to play, and La Liga is getting to play, and the Champions League are getting to play, and FIFA is getting to hold their World Cup qualifiers, we want our slice of the pie too. So it just seems to me like, no matter, they're going to avoid shutting down at all costs. Easier to just postpone games than to do a full shutdown. Because you don't want to trickle too far into the summer, which they will if they have to, because the next season starts earlier, because there's a World Cup in November, and there's no chance that World Cup is getting pushed, because FIFA's like, no, this is our slice of the pie, and this is where we make all of our money. And with all of the controversy surrounding the 2022 Qatar World Cup, there's just no way FIFA's pushing that back another year. And right now we're looking more like, it's not the COVID that's spreading through the countries that's really causing the postponements, it's the players. So like, I just think at this point, the league's going to be like, yeah, let's just put in, like, you have to be vaccinated, et cetera, to attend a game. And if fans want to attend, we're not going to stop them. So I think it's more, the reason that we're getting postponements is player related and not fan related. So I don't even know if we're going to go back to empty stadiums. I think we might just, the Premier League might just be like, hey, if fans want to come, let them come. The governments would have to get involved. And we're seeing that in Germany and some other countries. But like, you know, the English government's not going to get involved here.
Yeah, I'm definitely getting the vibe, too, that they're probably looking at the way, like, America's handling sporting events, because obviously COVID's not really gone away here either. I do get the vibe that a lot of decision makers are probably looking at it like, commit your own risk, but we're going to stay open. So if I'm going to maybe throw out some praise towards an area that we don't normally throw praise to, I was encouraged to see things like what Jurgen Klopp has put apparently in the match day program, encouraging people to get their booster shots. And you referenced the Super League just a minute ago, Paulie, and I think in kind of a way of like how we're going to legislate and, you know, navigate a potential, what is this, the 10th wave of COVID at this point that potentially could shut down games, is the financial decision makers are not going to make that call. So then we're leaning on people with influence, like the managers, who are probably going to have to stand up a little bit and be more in the forefront of, you know, encouraging people to get the vaccine. It's one of these things where science says it's safe. Scientists are a lot better informed than we are. And coaches showing that, you know, they trust the process, they trust the science. That's going to go a long way, hopefully, and maybe starting to deafen the misinformation that's going around. But certainly in the last week too, everything that's, you know, popped up in the news, I'm not as plugged into it, obviously, because I'm here in Virginia. I'm not in the UK, but it sounds like there's a lot of hypocrisy going around with how the UK government was treating COVID last year as well. So unfortunately, there's just a lot of chaos going around. So I wouldn't put it on the Premier League to be the beacons of, you know, trying to fix the situation, because it's not their job to. They just want to make money.
Yeah, there's been a lot of criticism of the current Tory government that comes across as almost, you know, like COVID trutherism or whatever, like conspiracy theories, just because the Tories have been constantly hypocritical in their treatment of the situation and, you know, directly violating mandates that they put in place, you know, to have parties and travel around the country and whatnot. And yeah, it's not a great situation over there, just like it's not great over here.
The thing is, we don't know what Omicron is. We're back in the days of lack of information. Delta seemed to be really bad and made people really sick, but only unvaccinated people. And Omicron seems to be, even if you're vaccinated, you can get it, but it doesn't seem to be as bad. And that's why it's been, and it's early, so, you know, in a week you can possibly be shoving this up my ass. But as of right now, from what I have read, it just seems to be something that spreads rampantly but isn't too dangerous. And I guess that's what you have to hope for, in that maybe we should just do a shutdown with these players and shut the players down for 2 weeks and then just play regardless of what else is going on in the world. But the hope is the long term, and that's what you have to hope for. Like, you have to hope, United have a bunch of positive cases right now. You have to hope that this really is nothing and then there aren't any long-term effects. If you get a bunch of players, even if it's just 2 of 9 that get the Paul Pogba version of COVID or the Kai Havertz version of COVID that lingers for quite a while and never, you know, it takes you a long time to get you back up to snuff, like, that could be really, really bad, not only for the player's health, but for United's chances this season.
Yeah. Moral of the story, get vaccinated, practice social distancing. It's okay to still wear a mask in public, because at the end of the day, even if you are vaccinated, you potentially can still spread it to people who are not vaccinated or people who are vaccinated, and the thing continues to persist. So yeah. Trust the science.
If you're worried about being made fun of for wearing a mask, just think about all the other embarrassing things that you show about your personality in public that you could be made fun of for.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So now that that has been discussed, should we just talk about Ralph Ball?
I gotta say, full disclosure, I haven't really been able to watch the games, as Colin's kind of alluded to. I've been pretty busy. I've gotten to watch a little bit of it. What I have dived into are the press conferences and all the content that's coming out. And from a surface level, just like a vibe, I do love me some Ralph. Like, and maybe that's just my affinity for, you know, kind of that German mentality, that German style. Of course, my last name's Heinchel, so maybe I'm predisposed to that. But he definitely is a complete 180 from what we've experienced the last 3 years, maybe the last 5 years. He certainly seems like he is really, really smart and really has an acumen for football. And so it makes me wonder what the possibilities could be under Ralph. It makes me wonder if maybe he wasn't coming in 5 days after the international break was over, and maybe he came in before the international break, as we have already discussed. I'll be curious to see as he continues to work with the team and develop it, and the players get used to him and they get used to the system and the tweaks that he has to make it work for the player base that he has. I'm certainly excited for the future. I heard that the Norwich game wasn't particularly great, and I am disappointed I couldn't watch that game with Polly. We were only a mile apart, but as the trains and bridge systems in New York work, I was hours away from him.
Yeah, well, you didn't miss much in the Norwich game. That was about as bad as, not as bad as it comes, because we've seen them play a lot worse this season.
Yeah, I was too busy drinking $12 Bud Lights at the Meadowlands.
It's definitely true. I mean, Ralph is, and this is well known throughout football, a very smart man. And if you talk, I was talking to Suede maybe when we hired Ralph, maybe a little bit before. And he had done a lot more studying and reading on Ralph than I had done. I've read books that have mentioned him, so I knew who he was, but Suede really did a deep dive. And he talked about Ralph was almost, he was ahead of his time. And that kind of was held against him, is that he was this big proponent of zonal marking and all these concepts that we see in the modern game now. He was just 10 years too early. And the way he went about it was just not in a charismatic way, and it wasn't well received. And then he talked about how Jurgen Klopp was basically the same way. And he went on German TV. He was a pundit for the 2006 World Cup, and he was the same way. We know how charismatic Jurgen Klopp is, and suddenly everything was much more well received. It is funny how much people want to bend over to, like, you can, I just don't get it sometimes. Like, you can praise Ralf Rangnick. He's a great coach. He's very smart. He is very entertaining to listen to. And I can listen to him talk about football all day. Full stop. Nothing wrong with doing that. For some reason, everybody has had to bring up Ole Gunnar Solskjaer afterwards and be like, oh, it's great that we have a manager that talks about it, that talks about tactics for the first time. Okay, Jose Mourinho didn't do that either. And right. Neither did Louis van Gaal. And neither did David Moyes. And neither did Sir Alex Ferguson. I'm like waiting for people to be like, Fergie would always explain his tactics in his post-match press conference, when Fergie never even gave post-match press conferences. You couldn't even get Fergie to talk to the press. Like, it's just one way or the other. And I think there was a comment made, or I don't know who made it or if I just saw it on Twitter, but it was just like, it just talked about how Norwich had it easy because we came out and told them before the match how we were going to play. And that's the downside to talking about your tactics. And that's why I always say, like, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer always got criticized for not talking about his tactics. And no other manager has ever asked. And like, when Solskjaer was asked, he'd skirt around it, because who the hell is going to go up there and say, hey, so my opponent is listening to this, so I'm going to tell you what we're going to do anyway.
And also,
yeah, who runs PR, I can confirm coaches don't do that. They don't talk tactics to them. They might share some things off the record, so that way you have a greater understanding of what's happening, so that way when you're covering the team, you can be more informed. But you are never going on the record and saying, like, this is the reason why I played a 4-3-3 today. Like, it's not going to happen.
You know, like, everybody, United tweets out their team news in numeric order. Or is it alphabetic? Yeah. Is it numeric or alphabetic?
It's numeric.
I think numeric. It's numeric. And it drives everyone nuts.
Same thing.
It drives everyone nuts. Everybody hates it. And if you remember 2 years ago, they tweeted it out in kind of order of formation, but like, they didn't put them in a formation, but like, it was like, it would start with Juan Bissaka and then go Lindelof, Maguire, Shaw, and then Fred McTominay, And so you could deduce how they were going to play. And then at the start of last season, they started tweeting it out with like jerseys and everything in the formation, and everyone loved it. And then they went to Southampton and Solskjaer switched to a diamond, or they did the Arsenal game and the Southampton match where Solskjaer switched to a diamond and was like, why are we doing this? Like, and he told the social media team to change it because he was like, why are we letting the opposing team know what we're doing before the match? And when United played Everton, when Duncan Ferguson was the manager there, he specifically told the social media team to write out the team in a way that made it look like they were playing like a back three. And they lined up like that on the opening kickoff, and then right away, player dropped back, and it was a 4-4-2. So
chestnut check.
Yeah, like managers would rather be misleading than actually. Fans want to know what's going on, but like the trade-off is the opposing team knows what's going on too.
Yeah, the only way you're ever gonna get the true picture, and this might be a tough pill to swallow, you're gonna want to first go to university, study an applicable field of study, work your way up through lower division soccer or football in your case, slowly but surely build your way up, and then get that dream job at Manchester United. And then maybe you'll be brought into the circle of trust to find out what the hell's going on.
Or you could just use your eyes. You want to know what the tactics were? Like, use your eyes. You want to know what they were trying to do? Use your eyes. Because a lot of times it was pretty obvious what they were trying to do. It's just, oh, we have bad players.
Yep.
At least for 2 years it was. This year, I give you a pass. This year, after three games, it was not obvious what they were trying to do at all, and there was no plan.
All right, so now I'm curious. Now we've kind of talked about Ralph's personality and everything like that. Were you expecting, Paulie, for us to go to the 4-2-2 that quickly? Because obviously Ralph didn't have that much time with the team when he finally took over from Carrick before they played their first game under him.
I wasn't surprised. Because this has always been an extremely coachable team. You tell this team where to play, what to do, they do it. We've seen that countless times. And every time Ollie's had his back up against the wall, and they're like, how is this going to happen? Like, the disaster against Leipzig last year. And then they had to play City at the weekend. And what happened? They came out and they played a very tactically disciplined match. And they went to Anfield last year, switched to a 4-4-2 with where Rashford and Bruno were up top and Anthony Martial was on the left wing, and Pogba moved over to the right wing, and they played a very tactically disciplined match. Even this year when things were all over the place and they switched to that back three against Tottenham, and they played a very tactically disciplined match. When you tell them what to do, they do it, and they're good. When there is a game plan, those players were good. It was just, especially this year, too often there didn't seem to be one. And now you bring in Ralph, who is a objectively good coach with objectively good plans. And if you tell the players what to do, they're going to do it. Now, there is the question of are the players going rogue? Were they doing things that were the coaches telling them to do these idiotic things, or were they just not listening to the coach? And guess what? 8 minutes into the Norwich match, we got our first look at, oh, there goes Bruno just running on the press again by himself, where Rashford and Ronaldo didn't follow along, and neither did Jadon Sancho, and the back line was not pushed up high, so they weren't ready to press high, and because of that, there was a massive space between Sancho and Dalot, and it was the goalkeeper went, oh, you're coming, all right, I see you coming, I have time to set up this pass. One pass, two passes, and suddenly, now they've not only broken the press, but they're running at United center backs because Diogo Dalot was put in a bad situation. He got beat. McTominay went over to help him out. He got beat. And suddenly everything fell apart because, well, Bruno ran straight forward. And it's like, yeah. Who told him to do that?
There were a couple of instances where, I mean, I guess I'll preface this by saying that I thought Fred and McTominay had a pretty good match because when things came their way, they seemed to be organized and they dealt with it pretty handily. The problem was Norwich didn't really go their way for most of the game. They kind of realized that the wings were opportunities for them to go forward and where they had advantages over both of the fullbacks. Alex Telles ended up tucking in a lot of the time, which gave them a lot of room on the left. And then, like you said, and like you wrote about this week, there were problems on the right between Dalot and Sancho. McTominay, as we've known for the past couple of years, isn't the best defensive help coming to cover on the wing. And honestly, we were pretty lucky to keep a clean sheet. It came down to two or three really spectacular saves by David De Gea, I think, that really kept us in that game, especially in the second half.
It wasn't even David De Gea. It was Norwich just being Norwich. Because that's the thing. I tweeted that at halftime. Like, if we were playing anybody outside the relegation zone, we're down 2 or 3-0 at halftime. And someone responded like, why you're better than this? Why are you making all these hot takes? You look at the data and like the raw data is fine. I'm like, the raw data is fine because Norwich didn't even get shots off. They had several instances where things broke down and like the ball kind of fell to Timu Pukki in the area, like at the 6-yard box.
Yeah, and they just kind of
didn't get a shot off. So it was like, yeah, their XG is low because this is how bad they are.
And also,
if you play anybody better, they would have made you killed you for it. And yeah, Colin, you were right that they avoided the middle, which is what teams have been doing for a year now, ever since Thomas Tuchel. Actually, not even Thomas Tuchel. It was Frank Lampard. Frank Lampard started the, oh, just let McTominay and Fred have the ball. Thomas Tuchel did the, no, it was really Pep in December last year, where it was just like, McTominay and Fred are really good at not letting you do what you want to do if you try to go up the middle. So we're just going to go around them and go up the wings, and you take advantage of like, are people dropping back to help? United didn't press this match. We talked about it. We were texting Saturday, 2 weeks ago when we played Crystal Palace. That first half hour was just scintillating. Like, it was incredible. And Nathan was like, it feels like I did cocaine. And that's possibly what it felt like. My nose started bleeding after the match, and I was like, maybe I did do cocaine. I don't know.
In case my mother's listening, I've not actually done cocaine. I just assume that's probably what it felt like.
And yeah, it wore off after a half hour, as you expected to. But they didn't even come. But the whole thing was that they got Crystal Palace rattled, and Palace were missing easy passes that they shouldn't have been missed, and they always felt like they didn't have time on the ball when they did. It's like when your offensive line stinks and your quarterback is getting hit every time he drops back to pass, even if there is no pass rush, he thinks he has 2.5 seconds rather than 3. And he's getting rid of the ball possibly before he should. They just didn't do that against Norwich at all. And Norwich just took the time to be like, their back line just took the time to be like, you're not coming at us and you're sitting back and you're cutting off all the angles. Fine. Well, we're just going to move a bit to create a new angle. And then you cut that one off. Okay. But eventually, when you're not pressured, someone drops. When you're talking about having a team that's filled with players who aren't great defensively, like eventually someone doesn't cover and an angle opens, and Norwich City, like probably the second worst team in the league, were just walking through our team with ease. That's a problem. And you mentioned Fred and McTominay. I tweeted at halftime that there was someone who was actually, there was like one player who stood out but didn't want to mention him by name because I didn't want to deal with the hatred, and it's just easier to say, it's easier to go on with the narrative and say, he's terrible and he's out of form. And I got a lot of responses that said it was Scott McTominay. I was actually talking about Harry Maguire, who had a very good game. And when I rewatched the match, I was like, yeah, McTominay was good. And he was really good in the second half. He wasn't anything special in the first half. I was like, which is when I got all the tweets. I was like, which was weird, because in the first half, he was McTominay. in the second half, he was better, but also because Norwich, there was literally a sequence where McTominay goes to pick up the ball from the feet of Victor Lindelof, and he starts carrying the ball forward. And Norwich's three midfielders, instead of coming to him, just are backing off. And Timu Pukki is right there, and he turns his back on McTominay and runs over to Fred. What does that tell you? How Dean Smith views Scott McTominay and Fred, and how Dean Smith views Scott McTominay, and how Dean Smith views Manchester United.
In a game where Norwich pressed at times pretty well, too, and were able to get the ball off of us pretty high up the pitch.
It was ball went to Scott. It's like ball went to Scott McTominay's feet, and they went, perfect, good, guard everybody else. He's not going to hurt us. That's where we want the ball. And I think that's part of why McTominay had such a good game, is because they funneled the ball to him. His touches were up significantly because they funneled, his targets were up significantly compared to other games. They funneled the ball to him. And I will say this, though, like Fred and McTominay played well. Harry Maguire had an excellent game. United's forwards did them no favors.
Right.
They were all, except Bruno was bad. Sancho never really got into the match, which is what happens when you play him on the right. As I wrote about this week, a week ago he was on the left and Bruno was on the right, and Bruno didn't get on the ball. It's not so... yes, United have a right wing problem, but they also have a pass to the right wing problem. They struggle to get the ball out there.
To be fair, a lot of places around the world right now have a right wing problem.
Yeah. Rashford was terrible. How Rashford made it 90 minutes in this match is beyond me. How Rashford has basically made himself undroppable this season is beyond me. Ronaldo, exceptionally terrible. And Ronaldo gets the, I played a terrible match, but I got to take the penalty, so it looks like I was good and I won the match for you, which usually, you know, goes to Bruno. Bruno could have been the I played terribly, but I won the match award. So forwards did McTominay and Fred zero favors. I will give them that.
I wanted to bring this up, actually, and I guess maybe close out the conversation on this, because there's been talk about Rashford for the last couple of weeks, and really since he came back from injury and hurt himself again in that Atalanta game, he just hasn't looked like he's rediscovered confidence or form yet. And obviously with more interruptions coming into the season at this point, it's probably going to make that harder, but do we really think that maybe him playing as part of a front two or playing as more centrally as a striker is just maybe part of the problem as well in these last few games? Because it wasn't just this. It was under Michael Carrick a couple times as well, where he was partnered with Cristiano Ronaldo up top and just didn't look that comfortable or didn't look like he really understood what the role was asking of him.
There's a combination of everything here. I mean, people are going to say, oh, he's been injured and oh, he's not match fit. He's played 7.5 games already. How long is it? If you're not match fit, that's a different problem in and of itself. You can't blame match fitness anymore. It's playing him in the front two. Yeah, he's not. That's not the kind of striker he is. There's just been this, I mean, this is part of why when I said the front two did or the front four did McTominay and Fred no favors. The amount of times that Maguire, Fred, McTominay, Lindelof, Telles had the ball and Rashford dropped in to show for the ball to be like, hey, here, I'm going to pass to me for a hold up play, etc. Here's an option. And on the first touch, he just went straight back with it. That doesn't help anybody and doesn't help you advance the ball. But like his game is not a back to goal game. And you're playing him next to Cristiano Ronaldo, who's also not that kind of player. Ronaldo loves to drop in and get the ball, but he does the same thing. He just goes straight back. He likes to touch the ball. Doesn't help. So Rashford's being asked to do things that's not his skill set. His skill set is as a second forward who plays off of a more of a target man player who brings other players into the game. That's what Martial's biggest skill set is. As a forward, Martial is not an out and out goal scoring number nine. He's much more of a Roberto Firmino who's going to people think that he's lazy and everything, but Martial does a good job keeping the defensive shape, and he brings his teammates into the game and allows them to thrive and create space for Rashford. He was very good next to Romelu Lukaku. He played in a front two with Lukaku plenty of times, and he was very good because that's the kind of forward that Lukaku was. He was not good next to Zlatan Ibrahimovic because Zlatan's not that kind of forward. So you're playing him next to a forward that doesn't fit his skill set. He also, his decision-making in the final third has gotten terrible. You see it when he has the ball on the left side, it's just tunnel vision. He just runs at people. He's just trying to dribble. He's just trying to get shots off, but like first he's got to dribble through people.
But and against Norwich, it was like that was the standout problem because he did a lot of things right, you know, for the, I guess I'll say eye test, even though that's not really what it is. It's like he got the ball in pretty good spaces. He took people on at times and won, and he was able to create shots, but the shots that he created were really bad. Like, there's that one that Cristiano Ronaldo missed right in front of goal that the pass was like just behind him. And that kind of seemed like just summing up Rashford's day at that point, where he'd made a pretty good run, but the ball in was terrible. You know, he didn't make the right decision when it came to approaching Norwich's goal area.
He created three shots. And like, so like you're highlighting the one good one that he created over 90 minutes when he had the ball in the attacking third plenty of times. I mean, there's two things at play here. Is one is you're using him in a way that doesn't best suit him. And the other is he is just, Graham Lasso was talking about the entire match was he just looks like a player that is completely devoid of confidence and he's missing simple passes. He's not doing things that he is capable of doing that you would expect him to do. His decision making's off. I don't know why he's so devoid of confidence, but especially because he scored three goals in his first three appearances this season after coming back from injury. So like, why are you so devoid of confidence is you got off to a great start.
I think part of it might actually be Solskjaer because I mean, Rashford was always kind of the player that Solskjaer, you know, valued and really built up and always talked really highly of. And it seemed pretty clear from the start that the two of them had a really great relationship. Maybe Solskjaer getting the sack has affected Rashford mentally, maybe more than other players.
I think that's possible. I look at it like the thing about Rashford under Solskjaer was it looked like when Solskjaer came in, he gave Rashford the freedom to be Rashford. And to excel. And part of it is he played him next to strikers that befit Marcus Rashford in Anthony Martial and Romelu Lukaku. And he did that for, you know, relatively an entire season and a half. And Rashford was pretty good. But then under Solskjaer, he never took the next level. He never took the next step. Like I've written about this. I've said this. You guys know it. Like if you look at his numbers, you look at his goals per 90, his goals and assists per 90. The dude is remarkably consistent. It's this, he's got the same numbers 5 years running. And it's like, you're so much more talented than this. There's no denying he's an immensely talented footballer. It's just, he doesn't seem to have honed any of his skills to the point where it's like, this is what he's going to do. It just seems like, you know what his threat is. And teams have adapted to that to be like, well, if we stop that threat, he's not going to be very effective. He had a, you know, watch out for him running in behind. That ball from Lindelof to Rashford over the top, very dangerous. It happened once against Chelsea. Two players ran with Rashford. Like they were like, you're not going to do this. And he was quiet the rest of the game. And when you look back at the Euros, so even though he was injured, every time, you know, he played, 83 minutes total in that tournament, and none of that surprised me. Every time England were in a situation where they're like, we need to bring somebody off the bench, and I was like, and people were like, they should be bringing in Rashford. I was like, why? Like, the way that the team was set up with Kane and basically Sterling on the left, it was like, if you want a shot creator and a creative player from that left-hand side, Jack Grealish is way better than Marcus Rashford at that. And if you want like a winger, like a pure winger, Bukayo Saka and Jadon Sancho are better than Marcus Rashford at that. And if you want him to come on as a striker, well, like as a Harry Kane type, he's not that type of striker. So you can't make a like for like substitution with him. If you want that extra target man in the box to try to poach a goal, well, Dominic Calvert-Lewin is better than him at that. So it's like this guy's a very good footballer, but he just doesn't, under Solskjaer, he never seemed to take that next step and say like, I'm going to become this great one that when I'm on it, no one can stop me.
Yeah. Nathan, you look ponderful.
Well, the thing that makes me wonder about Rashford too, and like what Paulie said, as far as the skill sets that he matches up best with out on the pitch, just looking at the roster right now, you've got two prominent forwards who are definitely under contracts that are more selfish strikers like Ronaldo and Greenwood. And then probably the guys that Rashford seems to play really well alongside Martial and Cavani both want to leave in January. So, you know,
he plays that well next to Cavani. On the right, he does because he's that creative player that could pump in a cross and Cavani could score. But on the left, he struggled last year.
Yeah. So if you take those one and a half dudes out of the equation, like it does make me wonder how he's going to fit. Granted, at the same time, too, he's hopefully still a young and malleable player, and maybe he's just going through some growing pains. And I like to think that Marcus Rashford is capable of adapting to the situation as well. And maybe that's the 50-50 split that probably needs to happen. You know, Rashford, as he continues to buy into Ragnick's system, and then Ragnick maybe catering some of the tactical options more to the skill set that he knows Marcus Rashford does really well, and kind of bring him along then into developing the other things that Ragnick really wants him to do well. The nice thing that we've seen is there can be fluidity of where Rashford lines up when Sancho's playing too, because Sancho seems to be pretty solid on both sides. So I really think it's growing pains. And we've seen Rashford have slumps, and then he comes out of nowhere and just bangs in a bunch of goals or sets up assists and things like that. And I mean, granted, this is still a team in December figuring out how to play with Ronaldo at the end of the day too.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, with the names that you brought up there, Mason Greenwood's really the only one guaranteed to stay at the club long term. I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo is on a 2-year contract. We don't really expect him to stay beyond that. Edinson Cavani's gone at the end of the season. Anthony Martial seems like he's already halfway out the door. It's not like Rashford is going to be short of opportunities to succeed under Ralf Rangnick. And like Paulie pointed out earlier, he's still got that sort of undroppable status, it seems, where managers haven't really been willing to look at other options than him. And I think, you know, some of that has come with his productivity, obviously, over the last few seasons. But also, I think we have to take into account with Rashford at this point, his personality, his sort of celebrity status, and his status as a Manchester United player are all really important. I mean, being a fan favorite, obviously, but him being the sort of player who would turn down big money offers from other clubs to stay at Manchester United, even if, you know, maybe he's not the best fit at the current Man United and he would be a better fit elsewhere. That's the kind of player that he is. And that's how intimately tied to this club he is. And I think, you know, all of that sort of adds into, you know, in some ways the problem when it comes to figuring out how Marcus Rashford best fits going forward at Manchester United.
Well, like,
yeah, I think ultimately he's going to be a guy that they're always going to try and build around or keep around, because I think he's too important to the overall mystique of Manchester United not to try and make him work as well, just because of, like right. You said, all the things that he represents, but also like he's an incredible ambassador. It's not like Manchester United should have to feel beholden to keeping him. I think, you know, ultimately they want to keep him because of, you just need to spend 5 minutes paying attention to what Marcus Rashford says, what Marcus Rashford tweets, what Marcus Rashford does, both on and off the field. Like, he's easily one of the most important players on that team, just sheerly based on the things that that he offers as a person and a player. So I think both parties, if Ralph is as smart as he is as a soccer tactical manager, he can make it work. And I think Rashford is a good enough player, and I think Rashford's a smart enough player that he can learn under Ralph. I mean, we are, what, 3 weeks into this thing. So I think he's allowed to have a couple bumps in the road here and there, because as we saw too, he was one of the players that made a big social media post for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. That was clearly his guy. He spent a lot of formative years as a player and as a person playing for and under, you know, Ollie. And so I've had in my life bosses that have moved on, and, you know, there's growing pains when there's a new person above you that you're trying to learn under and work with and just get to know as a person, to make sure that, you know, you vibe with them. So, I think right now, and, you know, maybe I eat my words in 3 months, but I think it is much ado about nothing currently.
Right. And like what Colin said out, he's kind of made himself undroppable right now. The ironic thing is who's going to be the number one guy here? That's Cristiano Ronaldo. And if you're going to play Ronaldo in a front two, he kind of needs to play next to somebody who's going to run in behind and run the channels. And that's Marcus Rashford. Mason Greenwood, that's not Greenwood's game. And expecting Greenwood to drop in and do the back to goal thing, also not going to happen. So, like, yeah, you could probably play Edinson Cavani in that position, but Cavani can't play. You know, every time Cavani's played more than twice in a week, he's been on the trainer table.
Yeah, it kind of seems like his they haven't said which tendon it is, but it kind of seems like it's his ankle or heel. Starting to really worry me, not just for what, you know, Cavani can contribute this season for, but also his career beyond this season.
I mean, this was Cavani last season too. It was laughable when people were like, oh, we have Cavani, he's our number one striker, and it's like, we should be getting rid of Anthony Martial. And it's like, no, like, Cavani's good for like once every three games. And then how much of a burden are you going to put on Mason Greenwood? And based on the first three games of the season, it looked like you could put more of a burden on Mason Greenwood than maybe one would have expected. But this is Cavani last year. If he played a bunch, he quickly found himself in the training room.
Yeah. I guess to close things out then, so there's been a little bit more Erling Haaland talk, and, you know, trying to fit him into this equation of Manchester United's front four. How much do we think that the squad has improved if Haaland is playing instead of Ronaldo?
He has 76 goals and 74 appearances for Borussia Dortmund right now. And Jadon Sancho assisted quite a few of those.
Yeah, I mean, don't break it down. If you break it to just goals, you're not topping Ronaldo. It's what do you do? It's like, because Ronaldo
is... Well, the difference, though, is Haaland is ascending while Ronaldo is descending.
That's true. But Ronaldo's shots and everything are also down. Yeah. Because we're not creating chances. And that was always our problem. We didn't have a goal scoring problem last year. We had a chance creation problem. We were actually really good finishers.
That's why we
got to get
Gio Reyna.
We were actually really good finishers. And then we went out and said, oh, let's just sign a goal scorer.
So it'd be cheaper to buy Dortmund, I think.
The question is how the Dortmund don't even own him. Mino Raiola owns him. That's the problem. The question is, how much does Haaland contribute in build-up play to help us get the ball from point A to point B so that we could create chances where our striker comes in? And I believe he does a little bit more than Ronaldo does. So, like, does our front line improve with Haaland instead of Ronaldo? Yes. Is Haaland going to willingly come to United, where he's going to have to take a backseat to Ronaldo for at least a year? Very good question. Do United want to get in bed with Mino Raiola again?
An equally good question.
I mean, hey, why don't we just have like a Jesse Lingard, Erling Haaland swap deal sort of thing? That means he gets double the payout for a transfer move.
He's not Lingard's agent anymore. Lingard's like really quickly.
Oh damn. Oops. Well, never mind. I'm stupid. Maybe I'll just edit that part out so it seems like I know more about current events than I actually do.
I read somewhere yesterday that like FIFA was trying to put in a rule that would say that like that caps agent commissions at 6%.
Mina's gonna hate that.
Right, and it would go into effect in like the summer of 2022.
Outside of the Holland,
don't know how good
6% of like 250 million still gonna be a lot of money.
I don't know how good the source is of that.
Does Mino have any ties to lobbying in Switzerland or wherever the hell FIFA are?
Surely.
Yeah. Oh, well.
I'm going to take a shot in the dark, just early days here. I think Manchester United's a better team with Erling Haaland. I don't have any tactics to back it up currently. I get the vibe that the best striker in the world playing for Manchester United probably improves the team.
Are they a better team with Erling Haaland and Cristiano Ronaldo up front and not addressing the other holes in the squad? Because
we're going to sign
United to.
We will sign Haaland and no midfield again. Can you imagine McFred playing?
So United to just sign Haaland and neglect other areas of the squad and then be like, well, Rafael Varane got injured a lot last year, so like we should also sign a center back.
It's actually becoming a meme at this point. The way Manchester United is recruiting really reminds me. And finally, here's our cross-sport reference. You remember in the 2000s how Jerry Jones just kept signing wide receivers for the Dallas Cowboys? It was like, let's not address any problems other than we just need the right. If we just get another, Michael Irvin, we're going to be straight, guys. That's all we need is just a wide receiver.
Let's do whatever we can to get Terrell Owens. You know, it's not a problem that, you know, everything else going on our team. We just need Terrell Owens. He's going to get us over the line.
Well, Michael Williams, baby.
Yeah. Well, I think it is.
Now that we're talking about the Cowboys.
Yeah. Cross-sport references. I don't think I have anything else. Another thing that we didn't have the chance to talk about, kind of in relation to Erling Haaland, the rumors of the bonus in Ralf Rangnick's contract if he's able to bring in that player.
Yeah, it's nonsense.
That's that was pretty funny nonsense, and I really like the way that he joked about it. But also, when he was joking about it and he was like, "Yep, 10 million for Haaland, 10 million for Messi or whatever," he included Joshua Kimmich, who I am a noted fan of. Despite his political opinions of vaccinations.
Get that boosting and come over here, bud.
And I think it's worth pointing out that Ralf Rangnick was the player who first found Joshua Kimmich in Bundesliga 2 or 3 back in 2014. So,
hey, what if we got Joshua Kimmich and Goretzka. I just blanked all of a sudden.
Well, Goretzka did sign that contract extension with Bayern Munich eventually, so.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Can we at least get Goretzka to be Jimmy Garner's personal trainer?
Or just hire Bayern Munich's training staff. Or.
I mean, Brent has been banging that drum for quite a while now.
Yeah.
There's sports science staff, too.
If we can't be great, we might as well be ripped.
Yeah. I didn't. Playing for Bayern Munich yet Joshua Kimmich is so against needles. That's wild.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to do it for us on this episode. Sorry for the delay between podcasts. Hopefully we'll have more football to talk about in the coming future, but it is looking like that might not be a possibility. So maybe we'll go back to reviewing season reviews or making Marvel comparisons for Manchester United players or something.
We do have a bunch of new Marvel properties we can reference, so
yeah.
Positives.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Auf Wiedersehen.